Welcome to the Retro Adventurers. This is a brand new podcast. We're on episode one. We're drawn together by a love of old text adventures and old systems. Each month, we'll bring together a group of adventurers, Mission Impossible style, and take a dive into the world of old text games and the systems that you can play them on. Some of the adventurers might come back every time. Others might only appear on high days and holidays, or whenever they happen to fancy it. I'm Ben Collier, I'm a BBC Micro and Spectrum Next enthusiast, and with me today are two intrepid text adventurers, Jason Compton and Dave Hawkins. Jason has been adventuring since he got a Commodore 64 for his 8th birthday. He's the author of Ghost King, the Scott Adams-style text adventure based on Hamlet. He was a regular contributor to the computer magazines CU Amiga, Amiga Computing, and Commodore World, and was the editor of pioneering online publication Amiga Report. Today, he dreams up impractical text adventure prequels, sequels, and pastiches, and can be found on the Puny Informed Discord. Jason, what have you been up to recently? I understand that you did a lot of work on the Osmu interpreter. There's just been a new release of that. Was it November? Are you still involved?
I'm still on the periphery of the work that that Frederick does on Osmu and Puny Informed, which is kind of the companion piece that helps advance, you know, more 8-bit retro adventures. So mostly what I've been up to is listening to you read that that lovely bio that I wrote for you, and I will be trimming down for you next time. But really appreciate you putting together this podcast and getting through the whole bio.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Dave Hawkins is also with us. He's been involved in adventure gaming since the early days. He played his first text adventure, Planet of Death, back in 1981, and he hasn't really stopped since. As well as playing games, he's the author of two adventures for the ZX Spectrum, Wizard's Warrior and Stranded. More recently, he returned to the adventure development world with three adventures for PC, The Eye of Borak, Tangled Tales, and Stranded 2, a long overdue sequel to the ZX Spectrum original. Dave, how's it going? Are you feeling better? I know you've been under the weather. We've been a bit hit by a bit of the old COVID.
Well, we have, yeah. I'm feeling a lot better, thank you, Ben. It was a bit up and down for a couple of days, but I'm here and very glad to be here.
Ah, fantastic. Now, I know that you didn't just build text adventures. You built all sorts of things, and the one that really stood out to me was the game that was a bit like Rockstar Ate My Hamster. What was that? Which one was that?
Star Maker. Yeah, I mean, that was probably, I think that's about 1984, 85. It was sort of a family project, really. My sisters were involved in that one, and they were probably the inspiration for it.
And Jason, I don't know whether this is something that's completely alien to you. Do you have Rockstar Ate My Hamster in the on the other side of the Atlantic?
By way of pirating it, yes, I love that game. But I don't think it was ever sold legitimately here. But it was definitely a game that
It strikes
found
me as the sort of thing that would get sued out of existence over there. my only memory of it was a kind of were the names of the rock stars being changed to things that were like grossly offensive versions of their
yes.
names, like Salt and Pepper being turned into Scratch and Sniffer,
and Iggy Car Rust, and
yeah, that's it. Yeah, I can't remember half the rest of them. Anyway, welcome both of you. We are a team, and over time, I'm hoping that more people join our team and we become a bit of a collective and swap people in and out as we go. So the way the show is going to work, it's like this. So first off, each time round, we're going to have a look at your letters and a bit of news from retro computing and adventuring. And then we're going to dive into a couple of old adventures. The first one we're going to call the appetizer. So that's like a little amuse-bouche of a game. When the first text adventures came out, a lot of them were quite small. And it's a shame to miss out on those. And some of them are really quirky and interesting. So we fancy having a go at a few of those. So what's that mean? The amusement, a mouth amusement. So just get us started with a mouth amusement of a game. So we're going to do that first, and then we'll move on to a headline act. So we really want to touch on some of the classics, maybe not the big, well-known American ones. Often
British, European games, but some American ones, but retro ones, nothing modern. We really like the old school stuff. So we'll discuss that game in kind of broad terms, and then we'll hit something that I've chosen in a completely original and non-plagiarizing fashion to call the spoiler wall. Now, guys, you've not heard of anyone using a term like that before, right?
No yes, grooves were eaten in the adaptation.
Nothing like that. No, absolutely. So this is us. We've done it in a clean room. I went to a clean room and I came up with this idea of the spoiler wall entirely on my own. So, right. So once we've driven through the spoiler wall, we'll have a chance to discuss solutions to problems in the game, in the non-appetite, in the main course game. So anyway, we put our heads together before this podcast and decided to look at a couple of games. Our appetizer today is, and this is Jason's nomination, was Around the World. I think it is just Around the World, isn't it? Not Around the World in 80 Days.
The name kind of bounces around depending on whether you're looking at the advertising in Softside magazine or on the game itself. Yeah, the splash screen, such as it is, just says Around the World.
Yeah, yeah. And then we've got the headline act. So we're going with The Pawn by Magnetic Scrolls. And I know a lot of people are really interested in hearing about that. So I think that's going to be a really interesting conversation. Anyway, before we get to that, let's have a look at the mailbag. Well, obviously it's empty, but we do want your communications. If you're listening today and you're thinking, oh, I hate what he just said, please send in anything you like. If you want to send us a poison pen letter, that's great. If you want to send us praise, Bitcoin, wallet keys, marriage proposals, whatever you like, all of that would be good. We're on facebook.com/retroadventurers. You can find us there. Send us your messages on there. Or I guess we'll come up with an email at some point, but maybe not for now. Anyhow, as we don't have any letters, let's move on to news. Jason, I think you've got a couple of things, haven't you?
Yeah, the first news item that we teed up here was a lost game in the Synapse BTZ series, which came out in the mid-80s. The games that were released were Mindwheel, Essex, Brimstone, and Breakers, but many people, including myself, were completely unaware that there's at least one other game that was in progress that was never released by Synapse, and that was Ronin. And there's quite a bit of research out there now, including a apparently complete archival copy of the work in progress for Atari 8-bit platforms. It's got the 1984 Synapse date, William Ataga credited as a programmer, David Alzafan, the author. There's interviews with David as well that explains the development of the game and its ultimate cancellation. And I'm hoping that we will be able to talk about these BTZ games, having come as they did after that first Infocom wave had already started to crest a little bit. And you know, we'll talk about how Magnetic Scrolls approached the market, how other companies did, and Synapse took what I would say was maybe a more serious approach to trying to get in on that wave, and you can see that with the games that were released. And I think maybe after we talk about one or two of the games, we can go back to Ronin and you know whether or not it would have fit in with what they were doing. But a great piece of archaeology that clearly was a group effort, so we encourage you to follow the link in the show notes and learn all about the Ronin. And from the more contemporary development side, my good dear friend Stefan Vogt, who produces retro style games and then releases them on dozens and dozens and dozens of platforms, if you are looking for a ready to play Dreamcast CDI of a new game, Stefan is your guy. Well, his Moon Mist Entertainment label and he have released what he assures you is going to be an award-winning interactive horror The Ghosts of Blackwood Manor. You'll take on the role of novelist Thomas King and his wife Cora as they move into a remote Scottish manor house just days before Christmas 1986. There's your retro cred. Seeking inspiration for his next book, Thomas begins to explore the history of Blackwood Manor, only to discover a dark secret that dates back centuries to the days of the great Scottish witch hunts. Like many of Stefan's recent games, it's developed in Punian Form, which is the new 8-bit friendly library for the venerable Inform 6 programming language. You can learn all about it at 8bitgames.itch.io, or really honestly, just raise your hand and say you're interested in Stefan's games, and he will come over to your house with a 6-pack and tell you all about how great they are.
So I think it's an interesting one, this, isn't it? Because when we were talking about the vision for this podcast, we talked about how we wanted to focus on old school games. And I think we sort of said, well, if something is old school in spirit, then we cover it, right? So I think this is an example of something that's possibly absolutely in there. It's got its old school cred, and we should probably be taking a look at it at some point. But it's a fascinating question, because obviously there are things that are modern that are old school in nature, but then there's obviously the IF crowd and lots of very fancy modern stuff that we're probably trying to shy away from a little bit.
And I think one of the important things about Stefan's games, and I will admit I don't know them that well, I mean, it's just the sheer number of platforms that he manages to target with them.
It's incredible. So what's his, do you have any idea what's the kind of the code base he's using to, what's he targeting? You mentioned it was Punian Form, right?
Yes, yeah, he develops in Punian Form, which means that he's outputting rather small Z machine, either version 3 or version 5 binaries. And he and some others have developed a script that goes through and just, you know, has all of the interpreters for, you know, basically every platform that's ever had them, which is a lot. And you feed the Z3 or Z5 binary into it, and it spits out, you know, kind of ready to play disk images for all these. So I tease, but I'm being serious. He'll tell you about, like, wow, it's on 37 platforms, and I'm like, Stefan, how many people are downloading your Dreamcast version? Yeah, but it's there.
It's amazing. No, I've used Punium before myself. It's a lovely thing. And the ability to kind of, you know, spit out something for the, you know, program it on your Mac and spit it out on the BBC. It's just beautiful. So I'm very, very happy about that. That's fantastic. And I'll look forward to having a go at that game. Lovely. So in terms of other bits and pieces, the Z machine interpreter for a whole bunch of different platforms of that code, the source code for that, has appeared recently in a GitHub repository owned by Andrew Plotkin. So Andrew Plotkin, in a weird way, he's almost he's very much a modern text adventure guy, being involved in Inform 7 and Inform 6, I think, as well, and he's found this stuff. So he's made that available online. It's fascinating, and if you're a coder or a bit of a geek and you fancy understanding how all of that stuff was put together, then taking a look at that source code, again, we'll put a link to that in the show notes, is really, really worth a look. The only other item that we had in the news for today, and I've added this because it's just fascinating, and I'm sure both of you, Jason, Dave, you're gonna know about this already. I didn't. I was looking up information about the porn and magnetic scrolls prior to the podcast, and I discovered this this magazine online, The Classic Adventurer. Is that something you're both familiar with?
Oh, I'm very aware of that. I've actually there's a review of Hyperborak in one of the last issues he published.
Well, it's brilliant. There's a fantastic interview in one of those with Anita Sinclair, who was obviously, I think, the chairperson, possibly, but definitely heavily involved with magnetic scrolls. A really good interview there that covers all sorts of stuff, and we'll get round to that later in the episode. So we're on to the appetizer. So the appetizer for today, as I said earlier, was Around the World. So guys, because first off, what did we all play this on? What were you using? Dave, you're on Windows machine, right?
I'm a Windows machine. I actually played it on Apple Win, which is an Apple II emulator. And I actually felt that I got a fairly good experience, as if I'd actually played it on the original hardware.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think you and I, Jason, were probably eventually on kegs. I wasn't on kegs to begin with. I think you had basically suggested that we should all be doing it, or you and I should both be doing it on kegs. And
I'd recommend kegs. I actually ended up on Applewin as well.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
So I started on something called Atari 800 Mac X, which was, it's probably a perfectly good piece of software, but I couldn't, the PO files we were using for this, it just didn't understand them at all, or didn't seem to. So I struggled with that for about an hour and eventually gave up and used kegs, which was great. So that was interesting. So, but you obviously have good memories of this from the past, right?
I had some memories of it because this was, and I appreciate you two allowing us to do this as the first short game here. This was, as far as I can recall, the very, very first text adventure that I ever touched, encountered. I must have been no older than 7.
Yeah.
And it was at some computer class in a community lab. It was Apple IIe's probably, and this was one of the titles that we were introduced to, and it was one of these games where I'd played it for 20-30 minutes, but it had always kicked around in my head as kind of this really influential thing. So fast forward some number of years, and you're finally able to research these things on the internet. But the problem is that when you remember something that's based on Around the World in 80 Days, for a while, you just get a lot of hits of the novel, and then in more recent years, you get a lot of hits on the more high-profile adventure game, 80 Days. So it's still kind of a little hidden-away artifact from 1981.
Dave, you presumably you had no knowledge of this previously, or did you?
No, it's actually the first time I'd ever heard of it. Basically, because you'll probably appreciate this, Ben. I mean, the idea of Apple IIs in the UK was it was just well out of most people's price bucket. But it seems to be a very common machine in the US. And I think that a lot of games that we didn't get, and I think we'll probably catch on this in later episodes, that there's a lot of stuff that the UK had that the US doesn't have.
Yeah.
And I think this is sort of one of those good examples of how there were certain things that gained notoriety in certain countries that completely missed in other areas.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this is an Atari. I think we all used it. Did we say we were all using it on the Atari emulator in Atari format? We're not doing an Apple II, the Apple II version of this, right? No one did the Apple II.
Dave and I both played the Apple version.
Oh, you both
played the Apple version.
Sorry, I'm going slightly bonkers. So it's that's interesting. I mean, a friend of mine, I had some exposure to the Atari computers. I think they were a little bit more popular in the UK than the Apples, just because
the 400 and the 800.
Yeah, that's right. And a friend of mine, his dad was an auctioneer, and one day just brought back it. Obviously, hadn't sold. Brought back this Atari 800 with some Star Raiders and a whole load of cassettes on it. And we just spent weeks playing all these random games. And I think one of my first adventures was a random text adventure from a magazine tape of some sort on the Atari 800. But Dave, what was your first adventure game?
I've thought of this long and hard. I think it was probably Planet of Death, and I'd played it on the ZX81.
Oh, yes, I think we said that, didn't we, earlier on in the intro? Yeah,
I think we did. Yeah, we mentioned it earlier on.
I was Twin Kingdom Valley. That was my, on the C64, that was my first one.
I played that on the BBC. It was the first time I played it. I played it at school on the BBC Micro.
I think the C64, they decided to make use of the C64's hardware sprites. So when you got the vector drawing of the very start of the game, where you have this vector drawing of the hut, on the C64 version, you get a sprite of a rabbit bouncing down the path. And that's the only difference between the two versions. So,
that's what funny you say that, because Bug Byte used a very similar system developing on one kind of main machine. I think they were using NASCOMs or something very similar to that, and then porting over. So I think you'll probably find that a lot of the actual games were created sort of as a global game, and then tweaked for the individual systems.
Interesting. Very interesting. So that's another one I want to put on the list for later, is Twinkling Valley. I'd like to revisit that at some point. It's interesting. I mean, around the world, I mean, there have obviously been millions of games written with this kind of with this theme. There was one that I played a couple of Christmases ago, which was this sort of steampunk remake. I don't know if anyone had come across that, but that's it's really strange. It was an adventure, but point and click basically with a narrative, almost like a branching story.
That might be 80 Days.
Is that 80 Days? Possibly. Yeah. Where you kind of end up on some steamship above the Atlantic and go to the North Pole and all sorts of stuff. yeah, that was quite good fun. In terms of... So I guess what? First impressions. Dave, 80 Days.
First impressions. The first impression actually was just a massive... nostalgic dive into, I remember how games used to look like this. second impression was how simple the command structure was compared to the games that you got used to later on, and how much the games had developed. Overall, I thought it was a lovely... lovely introduction to text adventuring, and had I played this when I was 12 or 13, I think I'd have been overwhelmed with it.
Do you think you would have even made it into the balloon?
This time around, I finished it in about 4 to 5 hours. But in retrospect, yeah, I mean, and had I been playing when I was 13... No, I'm not sure I would have made it into the balloon. I've got to say, there were some complexities there, and there were some struggles with vocabulary, which I think we all know that's part of text adventuring.
Yeah. I mean, it was particularly bad in this. It really had some charm, and I really liked the way that the dialogue was written. But I just found myself in this endless case of hunt the verb, trying to find all sorts. I mean, at one point I think I did investigate balloon to try and do some sort of examination on the balloon. And because of the way the parser worked, if you typed investigate balloon, it would actually give you your inventory. Because it took the first, I think, maybe...
Three. It only takes the
first
three characters.
I think it's three letters. Yeah, that's fairly common at the time.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So, and you... The other one that caught me out, and I figured it out eventually, was the fact that your inventory, for instance, or the system would give you the name of something. So magnifying glass, for example, but you couldn't pick up a magnifying glass. You could only pick up a glass.
Yes.
And that was enormously frustrating. Likewise, enter train station didn't work, but enter station works. So
yes,
it was just a bit kind of
a lot of go to, you know, go balloon go, which I think again is very common at the time, and I know that certainly a lot of the Scott Adams games are very much like that, very verb noun, and it's not always that obvious what the intent is.
Jason, you've played, this is a blast from the past, right? Did you recognize much of what you saw?
I mean, I recognized the thing that I always remembered, which was the very first puzzle involving the woman and the puzzle and the puddle, because that was the thing, that was the image that stuck in my head. Like, what is this game? I know that there was this woman and a puddle, and you have to get around that. To pull back the veil on this, I'll tell the audience, you know, when we were roughing out the concept for this program, we had discussed, like, well, when we do especially these deep dives into these more obscure games, you know, we're not just going to trash them the whole time. So, I want to say is that I actually think this is overall a very good example of one of those, late 70s, early 80s, ultra minimal two-word parser type games. And I say that particularly because, although I hear you two talking about your frustrations with the, you know, with the parser and hunt the word, the reality is that although sometimes the verb synonyms aren't supported or noun synonyms aren't supported that we would like, you can get through the game with a very small number of verbs, and none of them are crazy obscure.
Yeah.
You know, like on the other end of the spectrum, there's a Scott Adams game that requires you to think of using the verb hyperventilate. And like, there's no hint that you can do that. Need to figure it out.
Yeah.
Like this, you can get through this game with get, drop, I think, use,
yeah,
go, ride, and move, or something
and,
like
and
that.
And cook.
Like, that, yes. But there's, but pretty much, you know, there's nothing that like really goes too far,
yeah,
into the realm of like,
yeah,
I've got to think of a way to express this. I get it when we're used to having deeper vocabularies, we can be frustrated, but the mechanics of it aren't way off the wall. What I will say is that it's a good example up until about halfway through, when clearly the guy runs out of time and stops writing puzzles, and it's basically just move to a place, go into a conveyance, move to another location, go into a conveyance.
Yeah.
Like we can see the seams where it falls apart. But for the first half of it or so, like, this is a good example of, and this was from a monthly series of games, where for what at the time was a fairly nominal fee, given the price of software in the U.S. in, you know, circa 1981, which was, you know, really quite high, you were going to get a text adventure on a monthly basis. It wasn't going to break the bank, and you could, you know, get some playtime value out of it. So I think it succeeded.
And in terms of, I mean, the funny thing is, you know, we're talking about how much you could do with that two-word parser. I mean, it stands up by comparison to our next game, The Pawn. It stands up pretty well because, I mean, you don't find yourself concocting like five-word incantations that give you the right output, you know.
Absolutely.
So, yes. And you know, I mean, I came back to that earlier. It's charming. This is a charming game. We were talking about having something that you like about this. I found it charming. It the way it was written, the language, some of the you could really see the personality of the person who wrote this coming through. I guess the next question really would be, in terms of puzzles, and we said before, didn't we? We said on this on our appetizer game, we might give away a few little bits and bobs because it's not the end of the world, but we're going to be light on the spoilers. But we may let a few through. In terms of what was your, I don't know, Dave? What was your most frustrating puzzle you came across?
Well, the one that really stands out was having to adjust the time on the clock to turn clock. And I will admit, I cheated and had to look it up online.
You mentioned that before, you know, when we were chatting before the show, you mentioned that was a thing. That didn't faze me. I didn't have a problem with that. But I can understand.
That's interesting.
But the thing that killed me was the thing before that. I had to use a walkthrough to get it, which was the Blooming Pelican. And genuinely, I knew what I was trying to do. It was obvious what you had to do, right? And with that one, it was just the order you had to do it in.
Funny you should say that, because I actually didn't have any problems with that at all. I think I sailed through that bit.
Yeah.
It's
great.
It is interesting how people approach puzzles from different angles.
Totally. It was. I mean, with the clock one, it was just really obvious. Even if it was, you know, the things that you were given there, I'm trying to avoid giving kind of obviously.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I mean, we've got some stuff that we've obviously given away here, but, you know, I'm trying to avoid giving too much away. But with both of those puzzles, in one case, you've got a very obvious thing you have to do, but you have to do stuff in a certain order for it to recognize that you're trying to do it. And the other one, you've got something that's very obviously sat there. It's like, well, you're going to use this thing. It's there for a reason. What am I going to use it on? And then, well, what have I just been? Yeah. So it's really interesting. The one thing I did find, I don't know if either of you came across this, Jason, the fact that you could use a verb, and you would be told, I can't do this right now.
Yes. I think that was quite a common response for Text Adventures, though, wasn't it? When you had a limited amount of memory, and there were only so many things you could do. And it was almost a way of trying to hide the fact that it had limited vocabulary.
Yeah.
And in the convention of these types of games, it often means, okay, I just haven't done something that's a prerequisite. And sometimes it does mean that, and other times it's you're kind of getting a red herring.
Yeah, it definitely caught me out that a couple of times. It's like, I can't do this, you know, whatever the verb might be, I don't want to give it away. I can't do this right now. It's like, okay, right, I'll do it later. But actually, I was able to do that if I had just done something else, the prerequisite, right? It blew my... blew my mind a bit, but it was really genuinely enjoyable, and a good laugh, and there were some very funny bits and pieces in there. We had the gentleman who was apparently found himself in difficult circumstances, but somehow owned a yacht.
Yes. Yes, I wondered about that.
That for want of a meal is not available. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
The thing that I wanted to say about the puzzle design is that we didn't specifically say this. The premise of the game is that you are trying to replicate the around the world in 80 days feat, and you are challenged start from this gentleman's club make it back to your club in London within 80 days. And so you've got actually a little bit of a built-in scoring system. There is a different ending, for lack of a better term, for whether or not you manage that feat. So you could get a little extra playtime out of optimizing your path through the game if you were so inclined. But some of the puzzles in the game are tied to the train won't leave for 14 hours. The repairs will take 5 days.
Absolutely.
And the game offers us a wait command, which will eat up one or 2 days. It actually varied depending, I think, on where you were. But that doesn't matter. So all you're doing is you're burning up time. Mm. And what the author is essentially saying is you have to go solve a puzzle, which we know that. But if that's the case, why did you base it on a time thing to resolve? So I thought that was not great logic. That felt like something that maybe if the author had a friendly voice, sitting beside him as he was writing it, they may say, maybe don't base it on time if the wait command never helps you and the passage of time never gets past this puzzle. So that was sloppy.
Does in terms of the wait command, I didn't use that at all. In terms of the wait command, is that something where if I, for example, when I was waiting 14 hours for a particular thing to leave, if I had said wait, or whatever, I would have been able to just get on board, would I?
No, it still said that it's going to wait for 14 hours. That's why I'm saying
it's a missed opportunity, isn't it? Missed opportunity. Hmm.
I mean, there is something actually towards the end of the game, and I don't want to give any spoilers away. And it almost may have been a bug. There is a point when you can be jailed and you just have to wait to get out of jail. And the cause of your jailing involves trying to cross a sign with a certain object. But the object actually doesn't actually have to be with you and could be in a completely different location. And I really struggled with that. And then it suddenly worked. And I, to be honest, don't know why.
We'll talk about that one on the other side then, if you don't want to spoil it now, because
possibly. So in terms of, I guess we have to kind of come to some sort of conclusion here on our appetizer. I thought it was a very tasty appetizer. The thing for me, I've said it already, I thought it was charming and well written, but obviously suffered from the same thing that a lot of those games of that era did. But in terms of a novel idea, I thought it was great. Others?
I found it was a very good interpretation of the book, given the limited scope of the program at the time. But there is one thing that kind of stood out for me, and I think there were a number of puzzles that we now look on to be socially unacceptable.
Sure.
Yeah. Yes. Fair enough.
That said, I thought it was a really good example of a game at the time, and I actually thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah. It's good stuff. Yeah, I think I know exactly the puzzle you're referring to, and yeah, that's fair enough. It to be honest, it's like something from a film from the 1950s, isn't it? But
it was exactly like that.
Yeah, fair enough. But yeah, it was really enjoyable. And Jason, thanks ever so much for recommending it. It was a brilliant
starter.
Appreciate the tour through the past.
Right, so on to the main course. So this month we have the pawn. First off, guys, who read The Tale of Korovnia?
I did.
You read it. You read it. How did you enjoy The Tale of Korovnia?
It was fine. when we're going to have novellas some more as we go through our games here, and I do think that the feelies, the included stories, that they are an important part. They're important enough that the publishers, the developers, paid to have them written, paid to include them, and we should look at them. Now, how much that benefited me and enhanced my life, that's up for discussion. In some ways, it tonally set some expectations, and in others, it didn't exactly. But I'll be faithfully reading them as long as they keep churning them out.
I do feel like the Tale of Korovnia, it did add color to the adventure for me. It felt a little bit. You said there, they paid to have them written. I'm not convinced they paid to have that written. That feels like it was. I'm not going to speculate on. I'm not going to be uncharitable and speculate on how that was written. But it even had. I noticed there were bits of dialogue in there that felt like they were kind of repeated or being edited into two positions, or they'd moved it around and they assumed that they hadn't said something in the story before they, So it felt quite disjointed and weird to me. It was very interesting. The there were a lot of references. I don't know whether you. There were things which I just got because they were very much a kind of 1980s reference. There was one, a reference to a helicopter pilot, someone's possible paramour being Malcolm, was a helicopter pilot. And I'm pretty certain that's a reference to Prince Andrew. I don't know. Yeah, and some of the humor in there was pretty, I don't know. How would you describe it, Dave?
Odd.
Yeah, it felt like there was a. I don't know. It felt like there were quite a few, for want of a better word, dick jokes in there.
To be honest, I think the actual story was written by one of the coders.
Yeah, that's how it felt to me. I think that's. But yeah, I mean, it was full of. I mean, we had Eric's father was called Willy. And there was some things in that. I'm not even going to mention the one about the little people and their farming product, but that one was a bit I don't know whether that was I'm not quite sure what that was a reference to, whether it was intended to be what it came out as, but
it certainly seemed... it was.
I mean, does anyone have any idea who Gringo Baconburger was supposed to be? It sounded like it was a play on someone's name.
Well, I wasn't sure that it wasn't a combination. They hadn't actually just tried to take various names, but it was definitely an old one.
It's funny. It struck me exactly the same way that one of those names from Rockstar Ate My Hamster would have done. It felt like Gringo Baconburger would be if you took like the word gringo and the word bacon and the word burger and swapped them slightly. It was some other person's name, but goodness knows. I don't know.
It's entirely possible it was one of the development team. That seems to happen a lot, particularly in the ages it happened.
Yeah. It's interesting. So one thing that, again, in researching this, one thing that did come up, and I think this is possibly responsible for a lot of the humour in here, I was reading it and thinking, when did Pratchett first come out? When did Terry Pratchett first come out? And I had a look, went onto Wikipedia, and The Colour of Magic, Terry Pratchett's first book, came out in 1983.
Oh, there you go then. Yep.
And The Pawn was 84.
Yep.
And
well, To be honest, I actually felt it was more, overall in the porn, I feel it was more Douglas Adams style.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, off the back of that, I then Googled Pratchett Magnetic Scrolls, which took me, and that was how I discovered the Classic Adventurer magazine. And it was the team talking about another game, Fish, and talking about how Terry Pratchett and Douglas Adams had influenced Fish. So I'm pretty certain that both Douglas Adams and Terry Pratchett had an influence on this.
I agree with that.
Yeah, and that explains a lot about, that explains a lot about the kind of postmodern kind of feel of it. It wasn't what I expected at all. I think Jason, you said something a bit like this to me before the show. You know, the tone was not what I was expecting in the slightest.
Yeah, and when I saw the name Gringo Baconburger in the story, I'm like, all right, so we're gonna be in this kind of world. All right, which the cover art and you know box description and things of the pawn don't set you up for, then and neither do the first few encounters in the world.
Not at all.
But when you see that, all right, we're doing Gringo Baconburger, so this we're yeah, and I think that. I think in general, you know, it would be tough to be a genre writer of any sort, you know, whether it's interactive fiction or straight fiction or whatever, and not either be, you know, aware of and pushing back against the influences of Adams and Pratchett, you know, if you're writing something in 84 in a genre vein, either riding the tide or doing your own spin or saying, no, I will have none of this foolishness. I'm going to do it the serious way.
Yeah. It was just like you say, it was the box art that caught me out. Because you look at the box art and you think, okay, serious fantasy. I'm going to go into this and it's going to be a real kind of, you know, what, you know, just try and think, you know, but yeah, full on serious, get what you expect, genre stuff. But
and even the origin story of the name, where it's this idea of, well, you're this character dropped into these unfamiliar circumstances, you're at a disadvantage, so you are being used as a pawn. Like that feels. Mm. That feels darker and more serious than what some of
100%. It's absolutely the impression that I got going into this, and I mean I've got this on the show notes, like my kind of script here. You know, had either of you played this game before, David? Had you played this before at all?
I had. I mean, I played it back in the late 80s when it kind of first came out, and it was one of those games. I'm not overly surprised when you guys say you thought it was going to be more serious. I kind of knew the kind of humor they were aiming for, but. I mean, I've got different sort of memories of the game, and it was at a time when I was developing games as well, so I was looking up to this as what really was becoming state of the art at the time.
Yeah, yeah, and I think the thing I mean, my first 16-bit adventure was Thief, or Guild of Thieves, rather. Sorry,
I haven't played that yet.
So that's got to be on the menu later in the later in the podcast's long run of 1,000 episodes. You know, I mean, with that one I just remember playing that and being blown away by the graphics because I wasn't used to an adventure with, you know, anything like the pictures.
To be honest, the porn struck me that way as well. I mean, the graphics were really.
Yeah.
They were outstanding at the time.
Yeah, and the silly thing is, I mean, I played this on a ZX Spectrum Next. I've got this wonderful collection here, the Magnetic Scrolls compilation.
I've heard of that. Yeah.
Put together by Strand Games, I think it is. They did a kind of a round robin, and they've sent out the box art. So they've sent out all the bits, and they've sent this lovely map here of for another game, and it comes on an SD card with with a little sticker you can stick on the SD card, with the logo of Magnetic Scrolls on it. It's a really beautiful product.
It's got physical content.
Oh yeah, absolutely physical content. But this, the physical content here, I think, is actually, this is actually something that comes to do with a totally different game, actually, they sent free. But you do get the box art. You get the physical, you know, a physical box that you can put it in, which has
lovely.
A lovely picture of all of the games. It comes with the Pawn, Guild of Thieves, Jinxster, Corruption, Fish, Myth, and Wonderland. And yeah, pictures of it all on the back, and it's a, you know, you just slide it in with the other games you've got for the machine. But the irony, of course, is that because it's going on to the even with it being the Spectrum Next, which I don't, if you're an American listening to this, you might not be familiar with this, but the a team of people, including the original hardware, the original case designer for the Spectrum, got together. And they built an FPGA-based iteration on the Spectrum, the ZX Spectrum. But even with this being an iteration, the graphics are actually at a lower res than the Atari and Amiga versions of this game. So it's like a backport almost. Mm. So the graphics aren't as good. So I guess both of you, did you use Amiga, Atari? What was your platform of choice?
Well, I used, again, an emulator, and I used the Atari ST version,
yeah.
Which is, I chose that because that's how I originally played it.
Yeah.
So what I really wanted to do was try and capture the feel I had when I first played the game. And and I think I did that. And I actually, first impressions were pretty similar, really. I wasn't quite so blown away with the graphics because times change.
Yeah.
The actual game itself, I thought flowed fairly well, but I'd like to hear Jason's opinion, because I kind of want to go on a bit more in depth about the game, but I don't want to continue to talk. So,
Jason, what was your platform that you played this on?
I use the Magnetic Scrolls Memorial site at iflegends.org.
Ah.
It's if-legends.org, and that has a pretty nice interface. You can save games sort of in the browser session and also download them. It does have, I think you can toggle between what I'm guessing is the Amiga and ST art.
It's not an emulation of a particular platform. It's a
cross-platform emulator.
Huh.
Yeah, whatever the interpreter in the background is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it lets you cycle through that and. Yeah, so that for me, that it was, I wasn't worried about recreating the experience because I had never played the game before, even though I was well aware of it. You know, it was the kind of thing that I would have thought about getting however many dozens of times and just never did. And I've certainly heard people sing the praises of Magnetic Scrolls, and I just never sat down to do it. And I used to feel bad about that decision, and I don't feel quite so bad about that decision anymore.
It's interesting. We're all going to start getting a little bit. A little bit controversial here now.
But I did want to loop back to we were talking about the release dates and the graphics.
Yeah.
I was intrigued by the fact that when it first came out on the Sinclair QL that it was text only. The graphics were actually a thing that spruced up
the later releases.
That. Yeah, when they ported it to other platforms. Yeah, this was like one of the big Sinclair branded highlighted games for the QL. But that was text only. And the fact that some of the game felt that it had pretty constrained prose, at first I'm like, okay, they're saving room for the graphic, but that wouldn't have been the case in the initial draft, so that might have been more just about storage or memory.
This must have come out on micro drive to begin with, right?
You can see if you dig around, you can see the binder where it came on those.
That's probably what the constraint was, quite frankly.
But there were a few places where I get a bigger chunk of text, but others where I'm like, okay, I felt like, for lack of a better term, I felt like the author may have been just like, well, I'm on a hard word count, so can't go any further. The fact that not every location had a unique illustration that threw me a little bit. I feel like being, and I know it's not the only game series that does this, but I do overall prefer, like, unless we're talking about like actually identical locations, I think it pulls me out a little bit if I'm not seeing something unique for each location. Either let describe it and let me use my imagination, or give me something unique for each one. I was a little a little challenged by.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, going back to the kind of the Twin Kingdom Valley style games that had graphics back in the day, a lot of those used, you know, they'd use vectors. So they'd say, I've got this vector of a tree, and I can make it slightly larger and slightly smaller. And they would compose a lot of the images from, you know, they'd say, right, just put 20 trees over here and a hill, which is just a line, and then fill that in with some color. And they would use that to produce quite a lot of images. I would be almost willing to bet that Twin Kingdom Valley has more pictures in it than this. And I guess most games were like that. But in terms of even back then, you know, there were still a lot of locations in that game that didn't have, they didn't have an image for every single location. You know, you'd be in the woods, here is a woods picture, you'd move forward three times and it wouldn't change. I think maybe it was just the fact that was an accepted thing at the time, this idea that you didn't get a picture for every location.
Absolutely. I mean, I would certainly, looking back in retrospect, I wouldn't have expected to have found a picture for every location. They were more, pictures were pretty much there to say you've made progress.
Yeah, that's good.
See, the American tradition of, you know, like Sierra Illustrated Adventures, the handful that Interplay put out, you know, Tracer Sanction, Mind Shadow, Borrow Time, Task Times, things like that. Unless it's like, you know, you're on an endless plane, the plane continues endlessly, you typically get a new image, whether it's vector or bitmap, for each location. So.
I wonder what that brings us back to what I was saying earlier about things like the Apple II being out of the price range of most people in the UK or in Europe. Machines in the US are more powerful at the time.
Yeah, that's true.
And the fact that Americans were buying disk drives and even through 1984, the English were not.
Yeah. No, that's it. We were stuck to some sort of C45 cassette. And once it's in memory, that's it. You're not going to load any more information in, are you? Good shout. That's a good shout. The one interesting thing you were talking about, this being obviously started on the Sinclair QL, and when we were, you know, obviously we were looking at this at the various games produced by Magnetic Scrolls when we were planning for this episode, and you could see the number of platforms they supported per game kind of slowly dwindling as the market thinned out over time.
Yeah.
But this one, starting with Sinclair, I think a lot of people were under the impression that Anita Sinclair, who I think was used as quite heavily in publicity for these games, was in some way related to Clive Sinclair, but there was no relation there at all, was there? Did anyone notice the kind of Fisher King-esque elements of the Korovnia tale?
I've got to admit, I only skimmed through it.
Don't blame you, quite frankly.
I see what direction you're heading in there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, to be honest, it was so influenced by the works of others and fairly poorly.
Yeah, it felt a little bit like, I mean, without being too rude, it did feel a little bit like Pound Shop Pratchett.
No, I think that's a good summary. Yes. Whether we review, that would be it.
So, I mean, in terms of, I guess we're going to hit the spoiler wall. Non-plagiarized spoiler wall in a moment. But in terms of the sort of the game itself and overall kind of enjoyment levels and all of that sort of stuff, you know, Jason, I'd go to you. I mean, if you were going to rate this out of 10, how many thumbs up would you give it?
Ooh. Well, let me say some nice things first before I hit that. Things that I liked, that I was pleasantly surprised by, that I thought were overall pretty well implemented. For example, I liked that the verb feel was implemented. And usually, if you felt something, it had a quality about it that was sensible to whatever that thing was, whether it was, you know, a head or the but the blue or the red or the green. I wasn't sure why the green was clammy. We'll talk more about the red and green on the other side, I think. But that was consistently implemented. It did give the world the kind of depth and flavor that honestly was the kind of thing that both the way Magnetic Scrolls marketed its own games in the moment, you know, in the mid-80s, and the way people talk about them today, that was the thing that made me say, okay, thank you. I'm getting more out of this than I would get out of playing Around the World or another, you know, Scott Adams type adventure. I liked that. I liked, although I'm not sure how much it really mattered, but I actually liked that there was the command pronouns where the engine would spit back, here's what I'm currently considering. Where's the list? I had it in my notes here, but like it would tell you what it currently thinks he, she, I think he, she, it, and they mean at the time. Like, okay, that's cool. That's a nice
thing. Yeah,
into the engine. You know, is it a debug command or is it useful for the player? Either way, like I thought that was nice. I thought that the way that the talk, you know, the conversation type system was implemented overall was pretty good, was pretty flexible. Weirdly, with the merchant, it seemed awfully limited because I could not figure out how to get him. I couldn't figure out how to get him to repeat his inventory list to me. You get it one time, and I'm not sure I figured out how to get it back. What was odd about it was that some of the characters with the most to say, you had a time limit on asking them questions. It's like, well, okay, I'll just save the game because I want to see this content.
Yeah.
I don't know why you're hiding it from me.
I had a bit of a problem with that. I did find that when I was playing this, I kept on being caught out by the behavior of the characters. You know, it was very unforgiving. It was very easy to get into a situation where you really couldn't progress, as far as I could tell, once you'd done something silly.
Yeah, there were things though that you know, like compare, because we all know anybody who's played enough of these games or certainly tried to make any of them, you know that once you get any sort of, you know, say, ask, tell, you know, type of thing, and they're like, oh no, this is gonna get bad. I thought that for what it was, for when it was from, that I got what I expected. Modulo things like, how come I can't get the shopkeeper to just tell me what he's selling again? Those things I thought worked pretty well. And I'll just set this up on the other hand, and this is where I wanted to say that before I got to the rating is, I try to approach these games, and I'm going to try to approach these podcasts as, I want to judge these games as much as possible on what they're asking to be judged on. And in the case of a, you know, fully commercial, you know, game, obviously there's that amount of, would it have been worth my full price, you know, investment at the time the game came out? Am I going to get good play value out of that? In the case of Magnetic Scrolls, their manual, their marketing materials, all the hype that went out around the games really, really hammered heavily on, look how great our parser is. You can give these 30-word commands and they, you know, it'll all make sense. And that's where, unfortunately, as has really borne out for kind of as long as there have been parser-based games, there's almost no good excuse. There's almost no good reason. And it's extremely hard to develop puzzles that need a complex sentence to solve, because the more kind of verbs and nouns you need juggled up in the air, you know, the problem set expands geometrically. So the manual spends, I think, pages and pages talking about, like, oh, look at these things you can do. But really, you mostly only need to combine commands like that if you're doing a walkthrough, if you're retracing your steps because you had to restart the game. And there were a lot of places where I just want to look at a thing, man, and you're going to make me conjugate that in a more than two-word manner that I didn't need to.
Absolutely.
And so for that reason, for the fact that this game, I one of the things I may have remarked to you, Ben, beforehand was, I'm shocked that this game was Magnetic Scrolls' first game because it's so meta. So much of the humor is meta. This feels like a sixth game where you're going like, well, we've done this straight. Now let's do it silly. And so for it being that, for for talking up a parser with it. You know, they could have just said, hey, it's a pretty good parser. Have fun, guys. Instead, they really talked it up. I think I would give the pawn a 6 out of 10. Oh, and that's probably generous.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, talking about that parser, I mean, it did, to me, it felt like, a lot of the time it was a case of we've made this basically impossible without a walkthrough by coming up with an incantation of a line that you have to use that's no one's going to even guess. I was repeatedly having to end up going back to walkthroughs because I knew exactly what I wanted to do and I couldn't find the right way to describe, and it turned out to be a very complicated line of text. Which presumably was this attempt to come up with a complex parser. I've got examples here. We can put them after the spoiler wall. But I guess the one thing that did occur to me while we were talking about all of this was I wonder what year do you think Around the World was? Does anyone?
It was 81. 79, isn't it?
No. That was 81.
81.
81, right.
So this is literally, this is 3 years after that. Which is astonishing.
When you look at like that, how quickly things developed.
Isn't it? It's just, it's absolutely incredible. That from that game, with that, which was lovely, with a very basic parser, you know, this kind of, you know, three letters and then an object parser. And it came, so in that respect, I mean, it's staggering. It's incredible, the change.
I mean, I'd kind of like to sort of cover that a bit later and maybe do another another podcast. That I mean, I think one of the things that really kind of changed things was the game The Hobbit. Yeah. And that was where we first started to get complicated parsers. And I think from that moment on, everybody was chasing this wall of getting the ultimate parser.
Yeah.
And I think certainly from Jason was saying there, he's kind of hit on something with the pawn particularly. There were certain puzzles, and I don't want to break the spoiler wall, but the puzzle with the plant pot, that was just simply because they wanted to show how good their parser was.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah. There's no other point to that puzzle.
Yeah.
And it achieves nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's interesting, you mentioned The Hobbit. I just looked that up, actually. So The Hobbit was 82. So
yeah.
This is amazing. So you've got the likes of, you know, you've got the likes of Around the World, Hobbit 82, and this is a couple of years later.
I do have to play my resident American role here, though, and point out that Hobbit was the first to do that kind of to be that ambitious as a memory resident load.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing stuff when we grade stuff like Around the World, which, you know, it was meant to be memory resident. It was meant to fit into, I don't remember exactly what they were advertising, but probably was going to be able to fit in like a 16K Atari 400 or something like that.
Yeah.
When you get to Hobbit, now we're talking about it's a single tape load, but it's on, you know, say a 48K machine.
I think it was 48K.
Whereas, Infocom would have been selling games to the disc market, which in 1981 was, you know, for very, very rich, you know, families, you know, that, you know, are all involved in, you know, London finance. But in the U.S., it was a little bit of a bigger market. I must stand up for the world does not begin with The Hobbit, or I lose my American card.
No, absolutely. Can you think of a game? I know we're going to be slightly off topic here, but can you think of a US game that had a comparable parser to The Hobbit?
Oh yeah, any of the Infocom games, certainly. I mean, you'd have by that point
period?
you'd have some. Yeah.
Okay.
So Dave, I'm going to need a score from you. Scores on the doors from you. If you want to sort of comment on it beforehand in terms of your number of thumbs up. What are you going to judge it on?
Okay, well, I'm going to judge it on how I first perceived the game. When I first saw it back in the M day, I was awed by the graphics. Mm. I didn't have a problem with them not being at every single location. And I was impressed by the parser, but this is the point that I've got to say that I was developing my own games. So when I was looking at parsers, I was looking at these as a benchmark for where I should be. And at the time, I was very impressed with it. On the replay, I found it to be overcomplicated. I found some of the puzzles to... I had to solve some of them from memory because I'd already played it before. But I found myself having to go for walkthroughs more than I probably should have done. So overall, for enjoyment, I'm going to say for nostalgia, 7 out of 10. But I'm going to match Jason with 6 out of 10 for the overall game.
Well, I kind of, I'm totally with you on this issue of having to go to walkthroughs. The thing that really caught me out was that I was finding that the actual behavior of the world changes once you get to certain points. So, for example, and again, this is going to be one past the spoiler wall. I would go to a particular location. I would see something. I would think, right, I'm going to do this. I would search something. And there was nothing there.
Yeah.
And then I would, of course, not think to go and do exactly the same thing later, because how was I to know that object had suddenly changed and suddenly contained a thing later on? And then that was the thing that caught me out. I found there were a lot of, I think I mentioned that earlier, that I found there were quite a number of living death scenarios where it was possible to do something really damned stupid. which realistically were probably pretty stupid, but you could do them and it would just, yeah, you would be stuffed and you could carry on much further into the game and not be able to complete it. So
I've got to say, there's an instant death thing right at the beginning that really annoyed me, and I don't want to tell you what it is, but it was just so, it felt petty.
Yeah.
And I think you guys probably know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I think at the time, I think this is one of those games that, I mean, it's the beauty of it and the fact that, you know, in terms of the, you know, the experience, it was a novel experience. I remember being awed by these games when I played them before.
Exactly.
And I think it was the fact that this is it's a marked increase in certain technologies that perhaps don't, you know, people always talking about how, well, 16-bit games, you know, they might look prettier, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they've got better gameplay. And I think this is kind of a case of that. It's beautiful. It sells the machines that it's on. Do I think it's more than a 6 out of 10? Probably not. As a game, as an adventure game. That simple matter of the sheer confusion caused by a complicated parser and this ability to get yourself into situations that were unrecoverable.
There was definitely an overwhelming reliance on complex sentence structure.
Yeah, definitely.
That could have been handled a lot easier. I mean, I love the idea of the parser, and I really did. And there's things you can manipulate through it, but it shouldn't have been reliant on that.
Fair enough. Well, there we are. Okay, so we're now hitting the spoiler wall. Now, for those of you who haven't come here from another adventure gaming podcast, which we've plagiarized this concept for the spoiler wall is here to prevent you from having your games ruined by our overly detailed conversations. So we're now going to start discussing solutions to problems, maybe little Easter eggs, things that you would otherwise would otherwise be a little bit less exciting if you already knew about them. So we're going to do that. If you want to play this game, if you want to play the pawn and you want to have a completely virgin experience going into it, then stop the tape here and come back later. If you're happy to listen to this stuff or you've already played the game, then keep going. We've got lots to say. And we'll get straight into it. So first off, I gave the bowl of rice to Kronos. I don't know why I did that. It didn't make any sense. He thanked me for the bowl of rice, and then I was stuffed, basically.
Yeah, that was a bad one, wasn't it? Yeah, the fact that the game actually could be made unplayable. Actually, I didn't want to say it earlier, but there's certain elements, and this isn't the only game that's responsible for that. But the simple fact that a game that portrays itself as being so sophisticated could be destroyed by a single action is pretty poor.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of other bits and pieces. I think there are. Yeah, we talked earlier about the game sort of being, you know, unable, basically certain things not working and then suddenly working. There's a lot of that. I don't know, Jason, did you come across any of those kind of living death scenarios?
I know that they were there, I didn't make that mistake, but yeah, there are definitely some consumable items. And, you know, for a game of this vintage, you know, I always say that when we're in the 80s and you're talking about an adventure game like this, the content is the difficulty. In other words, you know, to give somebody those dozens of hours of playtime, even, you know, even at this level where, okay, we're going to fill a couple of micro drives or a couple of floppies on an 8-bit platform, to really, you know, get that longer playtime, you usually have to throw a fair amount of difficulty at people. And I understand that this is going to happen to us. But what was harder to forgive and to understand, and, you know, internally, Dave, at one point you had said it'll be interesting to talk about the different revisions of the game. Now, the version that's up on IF Legends that I played is version 2.3. According to their site, there is a 2.4, and that's the Spectrum Plus 3 version. So this is the penultimate version. And I don't know if you guys spent any time on the horse, but when you are on the horse, items that are on the ground are not visible. So I thought I had ended up in some sort of weird, you know, walking death mode, because suddenly items that I dropped weren't there anymore, and I realized I had to get down off of the horse
to
see them.
Yes, I found that. And it's because, obviously, from a game point of view, the horse is being treated as a separate room.
Yeah. And there was John disappeared, too. That was the other thing. Items and Honest John. And this, again, is where I go to, I'm going to judge this game by the standards that its developers have told me to judge it. And if you're like, oh, parser, we're so great. And I'm like, well, you're so great. You forgot that when I'm sitting on your horse, you need to make those objects in the actual.
That's not really parser, though, is it? That's more.
It's the engine.
Descriptive.
I mean, yeah. Whether it's a flag in the item description or what, like, you're telling me. Judge us by how tightly technologically advanced our implementation is, and I'm saying I'm on the horse and I can't see the guy who wants to sell me stuff.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So. The other thing, interesting thing about the horse was I the number of times I knew I had to give the, you know, I mean obviously Kronos as well. First off, once I got round the incantation of asking Kronos about the wristband, which was I mean, not necessarily intuitive, but once I'd figured that out, the issue I actually had was that I think I got to a point. I did something. I don't know what it was, but the chap on the horse completely vanished, and I was unable to find him anywhere. And so I had to restart a couple of times. And I don't know whether this is just unique to the Spectrum Next version. I'd come across him to begin with, and then in the next kind of two or three playthroughs, I just couldn't find him.
This is the adventure. You kill the guy and you put him on the horse.
You have to kill him, put him on the horse, and I just couldn't find him, and I had to restart several times before I could actually run into him.
I didn't encounter that.
Did
the
you not have
version.
That? That's interesting. I wonder. I do wonder if that's something to do with the next version. But
that's interesting.
But that was odd. And
can we talk
about
the wristband a little bit? And actually, I think I wish we'd talked about this on the other side of the spoiler wall, because it's so integral to I guess to the plot, and yet I don't feel like the game really earned the sense of dread or whatever that is. Like, I'm a guy wearing a marijuana shirt and jeans, and I have a wristband on, and I'm meant to understand that this is some dire curse, but I didn't.
Well, it was just it was it was thematically inconsistent, wasn't it? I mean, you go south from where you start, and there's this red line in the ground and a sign telling you that that's the end of the play area. And it's breaking the fourth wall. And you've said this before. We talked about this before the episode started. It breaks the fourth wall in a way that I wasn't expecting at all. I mean, it immediately broke the fourth wall on me. It totally broke my suspension of disbelief.
But for me, Ben, that seems to be that they were trying to make a joke of the idea that games were limited.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of how I always saw that.
Yeah, and I guess that was the problem. I think because of the, and we talked about, we're going around in circles now, aren't we, with the box art and stuff. But it's very much a case of, the armband to me felt like part of this whole shtick of, it didn't feel like this object of dread that I'd been made a pawn and yada yada yada. It felt like, well, this is just, the fourth wall's been broken. You're telling me that you've got all of these arbitrary limitations on what I'm allowed to do, and the wristband feels like another arbitrary limitation. Doesn't feel like some sort of plot element that's going to kind of make me want to care about the game. And I think that was the problem for me. It was this whole business of constant fourth wall breaking and a medieval fantasy with a bloke in a marijuana t-shirt or marijuana shirt, all of that sort of stuff. It made it so sort of funky that I couldn't make any kind of emotional connection to the game, and I like having that.
And this is something that I think I'm going to want to come back to as we play other games like this. But looking back on these games, and this one in particular, because not the fact that they go to the the kind of lampshading the limitations of the genre, and yes, you're inside a game and so forth, but that they do it so quickly, and both so quickly in the game, like you say, you can just wander a little bit and see the big, end of adventure line, but also so quickly in their own history. This is game one, not game six. I think that for a large chunk of the developers of that era, and again, even going back to the mainframe games of the 70s, it's almost like they were averse to sincerity. That if it, I don't know, like being the almost by definition, biggest nerds that you could imagine, and I mean that I mean that affectionately. But you're an enormous nerd if you are making this game or any game like this at that time. But if you just said, "All right, it's a fantasy in which you have no control over your destiny and all this," and if you just did it sincerely, like, "Oh, well, people are gonna think I'm just a big nerd." I'm going to have to lampshade it at every turn and wink at it. And there's a lot of games that do this.
I mean, when you go right back to the original Colossal Caves adventure, when he's talking Crowthorne Woods, I mean, even they said they were inspired by Dungeons & Dragons. So the intention at the beginning was obviously to try and be, to create something dynamic and dramatic. And I think by nature, we were almost taken over by literature at the time when we come back to talking about Douglas Adams. And I think that's the kind of style that I think, due to the limitations of actual machines over mainframes, we ended up with this kind of comedic approach to things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me, the games where they just do a bit of a nod and a wink occasionally, that's quite nice. Because you can go in and there's some, this, that, and the next thing, and maybe where something's just a little bit of a little joke in there, okay, fair enough, I know I'm playing on a computer, that's fine. But where, with this one, I think, and we've said before, it's of its era for, in a literary sense, because of Douglas Adams and Terry Pratchett.
I think
it may be less the case that, I mean, with the American ones, I think there's a certain approach. I do you know what? I don't know what you think of this, Jason, but I tend to think with the American ones, when I read a lot of those adventure games, this is going to be controversial, I feel a little bit like the Americans, how's best to put this? Their commitment to the fantasy genre is less because of American culture, in a way, and the fact that they haven't got this, you haven't got this, the same tradition of maybe I don't know, this is probably grossly unfair. Whereas I think in the case of British text adventures, in actual fact, what's happened is that we had this tradition, and actually people found themselves embarrassed by it, and so they started taking the mickey, and of course it all got a bit too much. It's a little bit like the punk reaction to progressive rock, you know.
I think this might be an interesting idea to develop over time. I mean, you know, remember, this is the birthplace. I'm not very far from the birthplace of Dungeons and Dragons. In fact, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin is not terribly far away from my home. And certainly Zork itself, you know, kind of the big standard bearer for the early fantasy text adventure in the U.S. and then the Enchanter series that's essentially an extension of the Zork universe. It gets pretty jokey at times as well. It kind of flips back and forth. So what I'm labeling as the lack of sincerity is I don't think is as much about where the author is as just when. I think that the who and when and where, that might be something interesting for us to track over the next few months as we do more of this.
Yeah, absolutely.
I will say something. I mean, just you hit on something, Ben, then about talking about the differences between the US and the European and the British markets, and particularly with the fantasy elements. So I know the US had a real problem with Dungeons and Dragons, and there was a lot of a lot of the idea that it was Satan worship and things like that. And I wonder what kind of impact that actually had.
So I guess, I mean, with the whole satanic panic and everything, and the, what were they, the Jack Chick tracts?
Something like that,
yeah. Yeah, these comics they would hand out that were kind of decrying various elements of kind of rock and roll and D&D and stuff. Yeah, eventually made it over here, but it was a lot later. You can understand how... Yeah, it's an interesting question, actually, whether or not people deliberately made stuff insincere in the US to avoid people. I don't know. Unfortunately, if only we had an American on the show to...
I think that's an interesting angle to consider. I think we also need to remember that the market... Even as we enter the 16-bit era, you know, with the Pawn, which kind of straddles because it is available on 8-bit platforms too, but even in there, the market for computer games is still fairly small. And even compared to because Dungeons and Dragons, could in theory be sold at any bookstore, so it kind of had that bigger potential cultural footprint. A lot of these titles weren't being stocked in most bookstores and not most retailers. So, but that's I hadn't considered that as it. But I think it's more about the when than the where. to loop back to the Pawn and what it's doing or not doing, if I can.
Of course, we went off on a tangent there. Sorry.
That's okay. on the one hand, giving them some credit for having puzzles that had nominally multiple solutions or ways to resolve them, but in certain circumstances, like the fact that you score a different number of points by voting for or against Gringo Bacon Burger, but it doesn't matter. And the only way that it seems to matter is whether you believe that the way it sets it up is the ballot box for Gringo is much larger because he's controlling the polling place or whatever. Yeah. So we're being rewarded for going along with the electioneering. I don't understand. But the only apparent downside is I have fewer points at the end of the game. I don't care. I just didn't care.
It's strange, isn't it? It's weird. It's almost like a kind of it's a sort of the creators inserting their kind of political viewpoint and maybe encouraging you to. I know it's odd.
Yeah, and along those lines, because it's tied in with that puzzle, and this goes back to the novella. The one thing that I could maybe say about the novella is that it tried to set up characters that maybe we would encounter in the world and care about.
Yeah.
And maybe the princess is one of those characters. But if you follow, quote, the main plot line, you can't get to the princess because you have to use the key on the stupid ballot puzzle. So the one character that you might have an emotional investment in from the from the reading of the novella, if you follow the, you know, the ideal path, you literally never see her.
Yeah.
And that was ridiculous.
Yeah, totally. The I mean, in terms of those, we were talking about the kind of weird kind of world changing stuff. I mean, the example I was going to go back to was the stump. So,
yes,
I searched it early on because it's right next to the start location in the game. You just go west a bit and you end up there. Nothing in there. Of course, I didn't search it again. And I'm pretty certain if you go, you know, the tree house, if you go up into the tree and enter there with a key. And go in, and there's the floorboards, and I tried everything on those bloody floorboards. I'll have to beat that. And
everybody's okay.
And nothing worked. I swear nothing worked. And I later on, I had to check the a walkthrough, and I'm pretty certain that was to do with when I tried it as well. So it just wouldn't let you move the floorboards. It said that the floorboards were dodgy. And so that's encouraging you to try and move them around.
It is, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah.
Definitely.
And I'm pretty certain it, in order to make the, to prevent you from going down, you know, going down there too early, it basically just wouldn't let you move the floorboards early. So it breaks the suspension of disbelief by just kind of making your abilities to do stuff change through the game, and obviously makes it quite difficult to play.
No, I totally agree with that. I mean, and again, I mean, now into the sort of spoiler wall, I want to sort of talk about a little bit about the plant, the pot, plant in the pot, plant pot. I can't say it properly these days. But I mean, that itself is a puzzle. I mean, it was really irrelevant, scored you a couple of points, but it really was about them showcasing what they thought the parser could do. But the parser itself then is let down when you try to do other things that complicated.
Yeah.
Because it seemed to me that it had been just so focused on being able to deliver that puzzle that it may only have been a kind of a hack.
I would be fascinated to see the code for that, because I genuinely believe that on some of those they were like, do you know what? We're just going to make it, like you say, a hack. Like, we will make it so that the actual incantation, and that's why I keep on using that word, because it is like that. It's like something from the, you know, Greco-magical papyri or whatever. You have to use that specific set of words, or it doesn't seem to work. And that it does feel like they've just put it in there to make it look as though the parser is more complicated than it really is.
Oh yeah, I mean, what you're talking about here, I mean, you've got a verb, an adverb, and a noun that are all doing the same job.
Yes.
And that itself is incredibly complicated, but it only works in that situation.
Yeah, and if it did actually turn out that they'd done some incredible programming to make that work, then that's good.
It just doesn't seem to be true. I mean, as a developer, I mean, I've actually got the engines that I've owed, Iobol, Icon, Tangle Tales, etc. I keep developing it, and I work on various elements of it, and I look at other games from the past and go, can I make that work? Can I do that? And I've got to say that that level of complication is beyond anything you'd really want to do.
So, I mean, likewise, I mean, uncover the wristband. That stumped me.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Couldn't do that.
Yeah, the term uncover.
Yeah. Why would I?
I couldn't get remove to work.
No. Remove shirt, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It completely got me. Yeah, likewise, I just took the rice bowl. And then I was like, well, what do I do with this rice bowl? There's nothing I could do with it. So I just tried giving it to Kronos.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe he likes rice.
he looks hungry.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's an angry-looking man on a thing. Yeah, so it was a lot of that. And, you know, yeah, just shine white at shadows. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was checked out by that point of the game, but
fair enough.
To go back to the plant and the pot,
yeah,
the thing that throws me about that, and again, is the kind of the why was nobody sitting next to the writer and saying, you know, this doesn't really make sense, because the plant starts as being described as inside the pot. So
yes, it does.
As insane as the whole premise of setting up to be this parser exercise, you're telling me that the plant is in the pot. So why do I even think about planting it? You've told me it's there. If you want to describe it as it's laying on top of the dirt carelessly, as though somebody started the work and abandoned it, then I would know. But if you
unplanted plants.
It just feels a bit like, you know, there's that story about, was it Sid Barrett from Pink Floyd? And he'd been a very naughty boy, and he'd sort of altered his consciousness in various ways, and was becoming more and more erratic, and one day turned up to band practice. He teaches them this thing, and they play it, and he says, "Oh no, that's not it." And then they play it a different way, and he says, and eventually reveals that the song is called "Have You Got It Yet," and the whole thing is just a kind of, and it feels a little bit like that. It feels like they're just playing with the player. And it's almost like they'd been kind of maybe consuming a bit of the thing that this was referring to themselves. And had kind of ended up with this slightly kind of onanistic joke puzzle. That's what it feels like to me. Almost like they're almost disrespecting the player at that point.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's entirely true, but I do feel that that they kind of got a bit ahead of themselves in the beauty of what they were trying to make, and they made that far more important than actually the enjoyment or even the actual ability to play the game.
Yeah, that's probably fairer.
And I've got another note here, and this I think this ties in, I think, with my sincerity remark, and also with my ongoing. I continue to be puzzled by the fact that there were so few games, projects of any sort in the early, kind of 70s and 80s period based on Shakespeare, which throws me because it's like the world's best known public domain English language set of properties, and there's almost no content for it. So when I ran into it in the pond, when we get the porter, and it's got, genuine Macbeth text, I'm like, okay, this is interesting. Great. Nice one. Interested to see where you go with this. And so you, if you, I don't know if either of you did this, if you try to go past him without giving him the whiskey, so he's already been saying, here's a knocking indeed. Yeah, if a man were porter of Hellgate, he should have old turning the key, on and on. So great. But then if you go past him without paying him, I'm going to read the game text directly. Quote, "You are obviously not going to pay me for my services, so according to my contract, I'm allowed to kill you." Unquote. As he says this, he smashes you over the head with an empty whiskey bottle, knocking you out cold. He then throws your body into the, quote, everlasting, unquote, bonfire, killing you immediately. You have died. All right. Like, if you want to just have a puzzle where you didn't do the last piece of the puzzle and so you get killed, that's fine. I accept that as part of the thing. But there are 1,000 different ways to kill somebody with that Shakespearean voice that you've already earned. Why aren't you doing it? Is it because you'd be too much of a Shakespeare nerd to just finish the job? It was I didn't do it on purpose. I actually just forgot on a replay to buy him off. But it really took me out of whatever it was they were trying to do.
It's odd. I found the Jerry Lee Lewis thing faintly amusing.
Another, if I can throw another sort of mechanical engine gripe in here, I like the idea of the exits command, EXITS, which tells you all of the ways to get out of a room, known ways to get out of a room. Yeah. That's great. However, if you're going to have a command of exit, which defaults to however it defaults to a direction, and that direction can kill you, that's not so fun.
did you actually manage to catch you out?
Multiple times, because
really?
I was like, all right, I'm trying to review.
Oh, no.
And just,
I didn't encounter that, but that's interesting.
Oh, yeah, that's
like,
nasty.
That's a player convenience that's not so great.
That's not so great, is it? Not great at all. I don't know, is this good or bad? I'm not sure. But at the end, where you're exposed to the sort of the programmers. I do wonder whether they'd been influenced by Jodorowsky. I don't know if either of you have come across a movie called The Holy Mountain.
I'm not aware of that one.
It's pretty psychedelic. With this character who goes on this great journey, and it's, you know, the whole thing is built as this incredibly in-depth, absorbing kind of, it draws you right in. And then at the end, when everything's finished, this is a spoiler alert for The Holy Mountain, incidentally, they pan out and the camera crew are there, and all of a sudden it completely breaks the fourth wall, and it felt like they were doing the same thing there. And that would have been really effective if they hadn't have done that all the way through anyway. As a device, that's incredibly powerful done right. But I don't feel like it was... although it was quite nice giving you the ability to then go back and sort of do whatever you fancied in the game.
Yeah. And, I mean, we can look at Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Or
true.
Maybe more prosaically and closer to home in the genre, some versions of Colossal Cave Adventure have a software den, you know, so that tip off, you know, there's coding and whatever going on. So,
I think you're right. I think the Monty Python is probably close. I mean, it's interesting to know when that was. When was the Python the Holy
That's
Grail?
That's like 74.
Oh, yeah. It's probably coming out of that, isn't
the
it?
The Holy Grail was later than that, I thought.
75. 75. Goodness me.
75, really?
It's earlier than I thought. Yeah.
Much earlier than I thought.
Hmm.
Wow. That's left us in stunned silence.
So, have we got much more?
I think we've covered everything we really should for listeners.
I think so.
Hope they've enjoyed it, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I tell you what, let's do we have any final words? It sounds like Dave, you're out, I'm out, Jason?
I wish I'd rated it lower. I got to that Porter thing in my notes and made me mad about the writing again. So I'm retroactively bump it down to 5. No, because like I said, when they started, I'm like, okay, all right, I'm buying into what you're doing. Okay, you know, let's do this. And they couldn't keep it up even inside the same room. And it just kind of sapped. I found myself sapped of enthusiasm for the game. I also want to point out we didn't really talk about the puzzle in either of the games, but we did manage to have two games with rope based puzzles, both of which had some tricks involved in overcoming them. I had to look for Around the World because I'm like, I know what you're trying to make me do, but what? And then I'd like, all right, it's the other time. All right, fine. And
that was quite easy for me. I mean, but I also found that quite fascinating you say that because it's the first, given the game's age, the simple fact that you actually use one object to do two separate tasks was really quite unique.
And, you know, it's a thing that's continued, like the dialogue language that Linus Akeson came up with a few years ago. His show off for that language is a game that involves the multi-location implementation of a rope, you know, because he wanted to show off, you know, what he'd uncorked for it. But yeah, the manipulation of the rope and the pawn, I'm like, all right, I think I know what you're trying to get me to do here, but if you weren't holding the rope or you were holding the rope, you died when you climbed it, and they're just frustrating things about that.
Why don't you just, Jason, accept me giving it a 2 out of 10?
No, that would be going too far. But let's see. I just some other things I'd had down here. That trowel. Was there a single object more important in this game than the trowel? Seemed like you needed it for everything from, you know, collecting up the lead to tearing
cutting,
wallpaper.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Didn't have that, you were in trouble.
Yeah, and it was very easy to miss, wasn't it? I can't remember if it was.
It was part of the whole plant pot puzzle. So you may have felt
it was
like
on
all right,
the
well,
workbench, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was on the work. Yeah, top of the workbench. Yeah, the plant was underneath. Yeah.
And I do need to pick on the parser for one last thing, and because it was a, you know, it was a timed single move, you know, kind of puzzle, and I would have been very angry if I was dealing with something other than the instantaneous reload times that the browser-based implementation gave me. So you get the potion bottle that you need in order to do in Kronos. You get to the final showdown, you've got the one move, and if you say throw potion at magician, the engine helpfully says the black potion steadfastly refused to be moved. The magician takes one look at you and his face starts to boil, and it goes on and kills you. And it's like, you know what? You knew what I meant.
But there was, I mean, there's plenty of that. That's another example of that sort of, you know, you've got a couple of moments to ask the right thing, or you're stuffed and you have to restart. You know, that's true early in the game. But at that point in the game, I mean, come on.
Can I ask how many points did you guys get in your playthrough? I got 345. I didn't care. I was using all sorts of maps, cheats, hints, spoilers. You know, I was just trying to get through this thing. I got to 345 and it was done. I'm like, I don't care.
By the time I got anywhere, I was using the playthrough guide. So I was on 345. I think I didn't bother doing the last. It even told you how to get the other five, and I couldn't be bothered. But it got to the point where there were so many magical incantations that were required for things that I unfortunately gave up trying and relied on the guide in the end.
Well, it's been really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've
covered
everything, haven't we?
Yeah, we certainly have. I think that's it. And I enjoyed this.
Yeah, I want to say thanks to you guys for making this happen.
Well, thank you. I mean, we all made it happen. And Jason, it's great to have you on board with your foreign perspective.
My strange alien
your
ways.
Alien way.
Your alien ways, yeah.
Absolutely. So I guess shall we when shall we three meet again to use a Shakespeareanism?
Well, I'm hopefully soon, so
great. Well, we talked about a next game. Now, ever since you mentioned it, Dave, I really want to play Planet of Death. I have to. I've got to play it. Come on, with a name like that. I feel like I have to always say it like this. I have to say Planet of Death because that's what it's called, right?
I think I mentioned before, Ben, that when I originally played it, it was just called Adventure A.
Oh, really? It's one of those.
Yeah.
God, it really is.
Only
yeah.
Came
yeah.
out about yeah. I think in the Spectrum version it became Planet of Death, and then it went back to the ZX81 version because there was a crossover between the two, that it started to be called Planet of Death.
Fantastic. Great name.
But it's really probably is my origin and my first introduction to text adventures, so yeah, I'd love to play it again.
Fantastic. Well, I'm up for that as an appetizer. I should think if it's a ZX81 game, we're not gonna make it a main course. But certainly.
I think it was a Spectrum version, so.
Oh, the Spectrum version. Let's give it a go as an appetizer.
Yeah.
And Jason, I think you talked about trying out some of the level 9 games, right?
Yeah, we seem to like the idea of doing Night Orc from level 9. I think that would be an interesting check in with where that
that'd be a good one.
Was around that
Sounds
era.
Good. Sounds good. Right, so next time round, Planet of Death and Night Orc.
You've been listening to The Retro Adventurers, a podcast about classic text adventure games. This episode was produced by Ben Collier, Jason Compton, and Dave Hawkins, with editing by Dave Hawkins.